Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It began with voice and drums. Now it's tweets and terabytes. Information is the framework of our lives, a framework now in flood stage. Science chronicler James Glick takes up the epic story in a new opus. This hour on Point, James Glick on our information age and where we're headed. You can join the conversation. Do you feel emboldened by our sea of information today? Overwhelmed? How is all that information changing us? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is James Glick. He's written on chaos and the genius of physicist Richard Feynman and of Isaac Newton. His new book is The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. Janet Maslin of the New York Times calls it aspirational reading. She says, ambitious, illuminating, and sexily theoretical. James Glick, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure.
Is it the first time your work's been called, or maybe you, James, sexually theoretical?
You know, it is the first time, and I've been puzzling over what that might mean.
Well, I think I have just a little bit of a sense of it. There is something really alluring about the big ideas you're pushing around here and delving into around information. If we can just start with the common perception today, the sort of sense of being overwhelmed, the kind of Tower of Babel feeling sometimes about the information that we are in the midst of. I read you here, James, bringing us some reassurance about that, that strange as it may seem, we're not the first to feel that way.
Well, that's one of the reassuring things is to look back through history and see how people felt that way when, for example, the printing press made it possible for there to be in the entire world 10,000 books at a certain point in history. Mm. At that point, already there were plenty of smart people who were saying, this is a crisis. Humanity has passed a turning point. It's now no longer possible for any smart individual to keep up with all of human knowledge. And then the telegraph arrived and the telephone and the radio, and each of these waves of communication has brought new examples of the same kind of anxiety, which isn't to say that we're wrong to worry about it. And it's not to say that we're wrong if we say it's never been this bad. It never has been this bad. Or if you choose to be optimistic, it's never been this good.
I found you've got some wonderful quotes from people across time and looking back through time here. One from Ward Just writing about Odysseus and thinking about how our sense of information, its significance, the very fact of its existence changes over time. Ward Just, wonderful writer, writing, Odysseus wept when he heard the poet sing of his great deeds abroad because once sung, they were no longer his alone. They belonged to anyone who heard the song. I mean, to us today, that's kind of an incredible idea. The fact that your deeds would be put into song, therefore not living only in your own mind, not so alone with them anymore, but we live in the time when what? You know, Kim Kardashian is out there and how many other people with cameras on them all day long, not feeling any of that wonderment, presumably, that Odysseus did.
Yeah, I love that. And one thing I love about it is that Homer was, as we know now, writing before writing. He wasn't writing at all. He was singing his songs and composing them to be remembered. And they are structured the way they are, and they are as beautiful as they are because one singer would have to learn them from another singer. And the only way that song of Odysseus could be passed from place to place was by human memory. Mm-hmm. As soon as the technology of writing came along, everything changed. So whatever worries one might have about the facts of one's life being broadcast multiplied a thousandfold, because now they could be written down and copied and preserved and transmitted over great distances.
And that really set people on edge back in the day. You write of Plato's deep unease with this fact of the recording of information in script rather than just in the memory of men, maybe women as well.
just another example of how people are always aware that new information technologies are double-edged, that while we desire them, we crave the benefits they bring, we also worry about how they're going to change us, because they do change us. And all of these early examples just feel like small beer compared to what we're going through now.
You've written a huge opus on information. We should go back to sort of first principles here and how you're defining it, maybe even how the definition of it has changed over time. You know, does information mean the same thing to us today that it may have meant to Plato back in the day?
Well, it didn't really mean anything to Plato. We're kind of inventing the idea now. I say we, I mean over the last century. The way we talk about information today can be traced back, oddly enough, to something that happens in science, in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
My book begins in the middle of the story, really, but in 1948 at Bell Labs, when the mathematician and engineer Claude Shannon created what he called a mathematical theory of communication and what we now call information theory. For engineers, talking about information, it was an old-fashioned word that used to just include things like instructions, court proceedings, news, gossip.
But it was used. The word was out there in usage, information.
It's an old word, but it just meant something vague. It wasn't a very important word or a very interesting word. No one would have thought that there could ever be such a thing as an information age.
But here comes Claude Shannon out of MIT, young guy, worked during World War II, laid out the mathematical proof of the security of the so-called X system, that hotline between Winston Churchill and President Roosevelt. He's off thinking about much more in terms of information's precise definition.
That's right. And he was working for the telephone company, after all, at Bell Labs. And the telephone company was interested in improving the efficiency of their transmission of sound over electrical wires. But it was starting to look as though it wasn't just sound that was being transmitted. Of course, we see now that they were at the dawn of the computer era. And computers, we know, are information processing machines. We use them for information storage and information retrieval. And it's worth stopping for a second and reminding ourselves that that wasn't obvious, that when people first started designing computers, they were meant to be calculating machines, and they were meant to solve mathematical problems. And people thought that they were in the territory of numbers. But it very quickly became apparent that what you were storing in a computer in the form of numbers, in digital form as zeros and ones, mm-hmm. could be something much bigger. And we now know that it includes practically everything.
So what's the vision? What's the vision, the meaning that Shannon brought to it? I mean, you remind us how breakthrough scientists bring new meaning to words. Isaac Newton brought very specific meanings to force and mass and motion, even time. These had been also rather vague words. What's the new nimbus or depth of meaning that Shannon brought to information?
Perversely, some of the problem for a scientist like Shannon trying to define information, just as it was for Newton trying to define motion, is to subtract things from the picture, to simplify it, to strip it down to its basics. So in the case of motion, Aristotle would have said that not just a stone falling from the sky was in motion, but a plant growing was in motion.
Mm-hmm.
Information used to be a fuzzy thing. It needed to be a precise thing. And so for Shannon's engineering purposes, he announced that he was going to talk about information as something that didn't involve meaning. It was just going to be data measured in bits, so that each bit of information is something new. In a way, you could say that Shannon was defining information as surprise, because a new piece of information that comes along, if you already know it, is not a new piece of information at all. It was inherent. And that makes it possible to compress a lot of data and create techniques for efficient transmission and coding and all the other techniques that underlie our modern world.
We think about bits and bytes all the time now. We take them sort of for granted, that like the air we breathe. But I have to admit, I could not define bit as a measure. I mean, how much information is like a cup of sugar? How much information is in a bit?
Well, it's pretty easy, really. A bit is a yes or no choice. It's on or off. It's a flip-flop in a computer. It's yes or no. So if you flip a coin, when you're waiting to see what the result is, you're waiting for one bit of information, and it's going to be a surprise. One bit of information can be very important. It can be trivial if it's just the result of a coin flip. But if you're on the eve of the American Revolution and waiting to find out if the British are coming by land or by sea, that's a single bit of information, a binary choice, and it could be transmitted by means of a single lantern in the window of a church.
So you describe this as a kind of rite of purification of the meaning of the word information, bringing it down to that measurement, down to even bits. What does it matter when it's so more tightly defined, purified, brought down to a measure? What does it matter?
Well, for engineers, it gives them a lot of practical techniques. That's what Shannon cared about principally. He wasn't thinking philosophically about the subject at all. He wanted simply to enable mathematicians and engineers to come up with techniques for data compression, encoding, error correction. There's always noise that affects signals. In radio transmission, there might be static, although not so much in our digital age, because of the techniques of error correction that developed from Shannon's work.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about our information age, where it came from, and where it is taking us. Behind me there's some Morse code representing the final Morse code radio transmission from the Titanic. My guest today is James Glick. He's author of the big new book, The Information, A History, A Theory of Flood. If we live in the information age, it's high time we understand it just as well and deeply as we can. It takes us a long way down that road. James Glick joins us from San Francisco. James, you quote Richard Dawkins here, the evolutionary theorist, saying on this front of information being kind of the base material of everything now. He says, and of course we know him, he's atheist, he's got his view. He says, what lies at the heart of every living thing is not a fire, not warm breath, not a spark of life. It is information, words, instructions. Make that case, James, that it's now information, nothing else, not even really material, that's at the absolute base of things.
It's funny now that Richard Dawkins is so well known for being an atheist. Really an important figure in my book. Mm-hmm. He's a brilliant evolutionary theorist, too, who at a certain point really helped reshape our understanding of what the gene is and how it works and what it does for us. And what it is, of course, is information. Because in the era immediately after the development of information theory, it also happened to be the time when James Watson and Francis Crick, famously, were discovering the structure of DNA, the molecule that carries information about every living organism. And often we think of that as a chemical problem or a molecular problem. What they discovered was the famous double helix shape. You know, we've seen it on magazine covers. Mm-hmm. But there's another problem that they were solving at the same time, and it was entirely a problem of information. And they solved it using language that was spreading through various branches of science because information was suddenly in the foreground. DNA encodes instructions. It's a kind of alphabet. It sends messages to proteins. There can be transcription errors, which we call mutations. All of these words are informational words, and for a very good reason.
But if I may ask you about that, I mean, we know that guides the genetic code. That's how life is made. On the other hand, if you're making a batch of cookies, you think of the flour and the sugar and the butter as more fundamental than the recipe in the book. But you say that scientists are finally coming to understand that information may be primary, more fundamental than matter itself. I wish you'd expand on that.
Well, that doesn't mean that we're going to be able to stop breathing air. You know, we still, or eating cookies. Matter and energy still have a place. But it's about the way you think about the world and understand its essence. And certainly in the case of biology, sure, we're made of atoms, but in everything that makes us interesting, what matters is the information at the core of things. the alphabet of DNA for an alphabet made of four chemical letters, that is able to store all of the information necessary to create a human being in just about 6 billion bits.
You go further. I mean, you're saying from this perspective, the whole universe is now seen, in a sense, as a computer, a cosmic information processing machine. Speaking of Dawkins and his atheism, of course, in the Bible, you know, in the beginning was the Word. Are these things lined up? And what do you mean by the universe as an information processing machine?
Well, that's an idea that starts to emerge in the quantum era when people start to try to make quantum computers. The great theoretical physicist, the great late physicist John Archibald Wheeler, who worked with both Einstein and Bohr and loved to speak in oracular monosyllables, liked to say, "it from bit." And what he meant by that was that in some sense that would be very real to physicists, it might turn out that the core of existence was not just matter, but was information, binary choices about yes or no. And from that, everything else was built.
I mean, can it be that that little human present human understanding of information is so fundamental? I mean, could it be that that's not some kind of weak read itself? It sounds like hubris to say, well, we've decided to put it into, you know, a black and white, yes and no, you know, zero or one, and that's the way the whole universe is constructed. That's the information base.
Well, it's not about us deciding. One thing we've learned about information is that it exists independently of human beings. And that's part of our redefining of the word. You know, it used to be that information would pass from one human brain to another. Maybe animals could get into the picture too, but to talk about information in the abstract didn't make a lot of sense. To think of information as something that could have a life of its own wouldn't have occurred to anybody. But we live in a world where information passes from machine to machine. And we know that when it's stored in material forms or in silicon chips, and when one machine talks to another, something's happening there that doesn't need human intervention. And so it makes sense logically to speak of information as something independent of us.
What does it mean?
When that happens.
Yes, what does it mean when we've reached that stage?
Well, then you start thinking that, well, that snippet of music has a life of its own. You know, you have the feeling of when you can't get a song out of your head, or when an idea seems to take hold of you, as we say, or when we speak of people dying for an idea, then we're talking as though the ideas have a kind of primary life. And that's where the word meme comes in. That's starting to become familiar to us in this computer age. Memes are little pieces of information that seem to have a kind of living stability and an ability to mutate.
You quote Douglas Hofstadter on memes, saying, "When I muse about memes, I often find myself picturing an ephemeral, flickering pattern of sparks leaping from brain to brain, screaming, 'Meme, me!'" And there we have meme. James Glick is with us. His big new book, taking us deep on the information age in which we live and the history of information that all of our ancestors have come through, is with us from San Francisco. His book is The Information. James, we have a lot of callers for you. Let me go to a first one here in Walterboro, South Carolina, and Beth. Hi, Beth. Thank you for calling. You're on the air with James Glick.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mr. Glick's points are very enlightening. In this day and age, I tend to think of information and communication as, you know, the high-tech computers and websites and emails and, you know, all
sure.
of that. And it's very enlightening to think of it in a more basic, you know, biological and chemical processes. But I would like to ask him, Mr. Glick, if he sees this evolving even further, and if it getting perhaps even out of our human control.
James Glick.
It certainly feels as though it's beyond our control now. And as I said a little earlier, though, the one little bit of reassurance about that is that it has felt that way for a long time. A lot of information technologies have made people think that that information had grown beyond the reach of individuals' understanding. It's more true now than ever. On the one hand, we can feel empowered by our ability to get answers to questions just by clicking a mouse or pulling our device out of our pocket and Googling something. On the other hand, we worry that the flood of information that flows over us leaves us gasping for air, mm-hmm. struggling to find the bits of information that are actually meaningful.
You quote Michael Cunningham saying in one of his books, his characters are saying, "I wonder, it's getting harder to see the patterns, don't you think? Such a volume of information that its meaning, its patterns can be obscure."
And isn't that really the human struggle in a nutshell, looking for the patterns? It's always been true, and now it feels as though it's harder because there's so much to deal with. We don't just have one newspaper to read on the subway in the morning. We have every newspaper in the world, those that will survive, available to us online. And not just one radio, not just whatever local radio stations happen to be within our reach, but if you're in South Carolina, you can listen to a Boston radio station across the internet. So that's a lot of choices. And choice is a good thing. We want it, but it's also scary and creates tension.
Isn't there a difference in scale, though, here? I mean, Beth is pointing at what's changed. You talk about this enormous scale change that always been the apprehension about growing information flows. But, I mean, when you get into terabytes and the gigantic scale of information that we're into now, is it not fundamentally different? Or do you see it as just the same as somebody upset about how fast the telegram comes with news from Wichita?
No, I do think it's fundamentally different. I think everything changes now. It used to be in ancient times, one human being in the course of a lifetime would have the ability to communicate with tens or perhaps hundreds of other human beings. Now, we have the ability to communicate with billions, literally billions, each of us. Anyone who can send a Twitter message of 140 characters may think that you can't say much profound in 140 characters, but billions can read that. And not only that, the messages are not vanishing into the air the way the spoken word is, but they're being stored for all eternity.
But doesn't that change our fundamental reality? Doesn't that change the future? You quote David Watson, I guess, the founder of IBM, saying thought, with directly related information, thought interferes with the probability of events and, in the long run, therefore, with entropy. Isn't that saying that the cumulative weight of all this information and our handling and engineering of it changes the world around us, changes the future?
There's no doubt about it, but I don't think we have to panic. And I can't necessarily defend that. I may just be congenitally optimistic. But I think what's happening is we're in, well, you could say a period of adjustment. It might be a never-ending period of adjustment, but
yeah.
We're learning new strategies, and sometimes the new strategies are old strategies too, but we need to learn how to search. That's why Google has become such an iconic, powerful enterprise of our time. We need to learn how to filter so that we can block out the unwanted information, when we may need to learn all over again how to forget.
Wow. James Gluck writes, "We are all patrons of the Library of Babel now, Babel as you like, and we are the librarians too." Mike in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air with James Gluck.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question for James would be, with all the sort of wikis popping up all over the place and the speed of information increasing and how fast we can absorb it, how do we deal with, like, the moral implications, how should information be used? And, if people aren't necessarily earning the information, if they're not going through, years of study, if they're just, getting on Wikipedia and looking something up, how do they know if they're using that information for the right thing?
Wow. James, that's a great, deep question. Thank you, Mike. James.
It is. And it's, in a way, it's two questions in one. Morality is a tough subject. I mean, there's an implication in the question that if things come too easily, they aren't worth as much.
Unearned.
That's right. that, you know, if you're a student and you copy your paper from Wikipedia, well, not only is that immoral, but it's kind of useless. On the other hand, the fact that it's easier, millions of times easier, to find basic information doesn't necessarily mean that our use of the information has to be facile. I certainly used Wikipedia all the time when I was researching my book. And not only that, I used Google's digitization of books to save me trips to the library. Things came a lot easier to me this time around than they had in my previous books. But it didn't make the work of writing the book or organizing the book or trying to understand myself what I wanted to say any easier.
Well, I wonder about that. I mean, Homer had Odysseus, you know, sailing for years and years away from family and home and, you know, great monsters and all the rest. And it was metaphorical, but it wasn't. People had journeys like that. Then there was a visceral, tactile element to the learning, to the information gathering that we're now blowing by at, you know, light speed, almost literally.
But we still have a lot of work to do, maybe more work than ever, just because there's so much information pouring over us. We still have individual responsibility to be creative, to be original. It's harder than ever to be original when you can instantly find out what everybody else is doing.
Are we made to be, as you say, the librarians? You say we're all the librarians now. Are we made as humans for that role?
I believe we are. I said that because we need to think of ourselves not just as passive consumers of information, but also as its creators and its guardians, because we are. More than ever, now that anyone in the world has the ability to be a blogger and to create a website and to be his or her own publisher.
Alan writes to us here online, he says, the information age is an extension, a magnification of what processes were afoot in the industrial age. And he writes, each individual must make a choice, Alan says, as to what extent he, she, will be part of this ever larger and more complex organism, whose purposes are less and less clear to that individual. What about the element of choice here in the information flood, as you have it, James?
Well, again, I've said I was an optimist. I believe we do have choices, even though sometimes we feel choices are being taken away from us.
Do we have the choice of sitting it out, though, or are we swept in it, whether or not we want to be that plugged in?
Well, occasionally we have the choice of turning off our cell phones and taking a walk on the beach without it. Certainly plenty of us feel that's difficult, increasingly difficult, that the connectivity to everyone else is like the air we breathe. And if we get cut off for too long, we start to choke. But that's why it's important, I think, to remind ourselves that we are choosing, that if we want to participate in these information riches, we can. But if we feel that the riches come with a cost that is separate us from a more real kind of experience, then that's our choice too.
We've just got a few seconds before the break. You say humans have always wrestled with this, but are we more behind the curve of what's available in our time than our ancestors were? Were they literally as overwhelmed as we can be today by drumbeats and telegrams and, I don't know, carrier pigeons?
No, they certainly weren't, but they felt as though they were. So it's a luxury for us to be able to look back now and say, wow, they had no idea.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about our information age, where it came from, and where it is taking us. James Glick is my guest. He joins us from San Francisco, author of the big new opus, The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. And if you're listening and thinking that you are a, you know, skinny-jeaned hipster, understanding this like nobody before, listen to this. James Glick quotes Nathaniel Hawthorne, no less, Scarlet Letter and all the rest. This is all the way back in 1851. Here from Nathaniel Hawthorne. He says, is it a fact, or have I dreamt it, that by means of electricity, the world of matter has become a great nerve, vibrating thousands of miles in a breathless point of time? Rather, the round globe is a vast head, a brain instinct with intelligence, or shall we say, it is itself a thought, nothing but thought, and no longer the substance which we deemed it. Nathaniel Hawthorne, 1851. James, look, we're hardly new to this terrain. Wow, people were really pushing their minds forward early on. I mean, they were still out with tomahawks in the woods.
I'm pretty sure that Hawthorne was a skinny-jeaned hipster in his time.
No doubt. No doubt. It's no disrespect.
Well, one of the pieces of the story that I found most surprising was the telegraph age and how many of our modern ideas were formed then. As soon as wires started stretching around the globe and people were sending messages, all of our modern ideas about world brain and the hive mind and a global consciousness started occurring to people. And people talked about the annihilation of space and time, and people had this idea that maybe as a giant connected organism, humanity as a whole would be smarter than individuals were. That's something we still think about today. I mean, we worry about being assimilated by the Borg, too.
Yeah, feed us just a little bit of technology, and our imaginations will run in a hurry all the way back to Hawthorne. Let me get a call here from Evansville, Indiana, and Keith. Keith, thank you so much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I appreciate having the chance to share some information.
Yeah.
I think that it's a sign of how many times I had to dial, how many busy signals I heard. The interest of what you all are talking about stimulates in our society today.
Very true.
I was a business major when I was first in college and returned to the university setting as a liberal arts major and read Homer's work in my mid-40s. And so it's written down. And in it, I read of Ulysses and his the existence of an anxiety disorder in him when he cried in front of his fellow warriors about the death that they had seen.
Yes.
And I was back in college because I was a Vietnam vet suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and attempting to rehabilitate myself. Today, we see with this incredible access to information, we see every tragedy that occurs, and we see it up close, and we see the suffering throughout the Middle East now and in Japan. And I'm not certain, your guest said a while ago that we need a chance to change and to be able to process all this information. I think that stress disorders seem to be rampant in America today, and I think this information has something to do with it, this flood. And I'm sorry I took so long, but that was kind of the point I was wanting to make, that anxiety disorders are old, and but now they seem to be rampant.
Keith, I'm so glad for that. I mean, go all the way back to Homer, and he understood it. And now this is it's a great week for this observation, James Glick, when we're all looking around the world.
Is.
I mean, good Lord, from the meltdown in Japan to, you know, all those people being fired on in Yemen. And we know about all of it. We know about it constantly. What about? Is it possible? Keith is saying, you know, we may all live in a kind of stress disorder right now.
That's true. And Keith, look what your starting point is. You get some comfort, I think, from exposure to the shared experience of Odysseus, as Homer describes it. In our time, we have access to shared experiences from people all across the globe, not just the people in our tribe or in our immediate circle.
Or boat.
That's right. And it's a mixed blessing because some of those experiences are painful and tragic. And right at this moment, we're hypnotized by some of the horrible suffering that we can see in the wake of the earthquake in Japan, and we're excited and maybe thrilled by the change that's underway in the Middle East, and there is such a thing as information fatigue, and there's people even talk about compassion fatigue and say, you know, I've got enough trouble worrying about my sick parents. How can I worry about all these poor people in Japan? But other people think, you know, it's the world is connected now and we can help and we can share information. And I'm starting to sound a little platitudinous
well, it's
now.
All
but
right.
All I'm trying to say
is, I think people worry about all the worry sometimes, just the very volume of it. And I wonder, as I read this, James, I wonder where you think we are in the arc of coming to grips with, terms with, handling this, the flood, as you call it, the information age. You quote, and you've got so many wonderful citations here, but Marshall McLuhan saying, this is back in 1962, and he said that we are today as far into the electric age as the Elizabethans had advanced into the typographical and mechanical age. This is 62, he wrote. And we are experiencing the same confusions and indecisions which they had felt when living simultaneously in two contrasted forms of society and experience. Where are we in the transition? Are we still wading into this flood? Or are, you know, are we half back in a simpler time? Are we well into it? Where do you see us in the arc of entry?
I think all we can say is that we're en route. We're in the middle of a bumpy ride. And sometimes it feels as though it can't get any worse. We have to reach a breaking point. There just can't be any more information. At a certain point, you have infinite access. But I think it's safe to say that the story is far from over, that our machines are going to continue to get smarter, that our habit of reaching for some tiny device to get an answer for a question is going to become more ingrained. The tiny devices will be everywhere. We'll carry them around, and they will be embedded in our bodies. And we'll still be worrying, I venture to predict, about the same things. We'll be worrying about trying to find a balance.
And looking at information as maybe the material of all that balance. Danielle, in Buffalo, New York. Danielle, thanks for calling. You're on the air with James Glick.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Glick.
Hi.
My father was a telecommunications engineer named Donald Simpson, and he worked for Pac-Bell, and he attended all the standards meetings in order to standardize the telephones across the world. And he knew Claude Shannon.
Claude Shannon, James Glick's great hero.
Oh, he was my father's hero, too. My father talked about him all the time, what a genius he was. But I remember a very funny story that my father told when he was at one of the standards meetings with Claude Shannon, that even though he was this incredible genius and revered, my father and he played a game of hide-and-seek at the standards meetings.
That's fantastic. That the world-changing genius is what, hopping around behind chairs and tables.
Basically, yeah.
Well, that is good to hear. Shannon loved games, and he loved puzzles. And even though sometimes he was fairly reclusive and shy, he was also playful, and he was known for riding his unicycle up and down the corridors of Bell Labs and then MIT. And he was fascinated by juggling and tried to build a machine that would juggle. And early on, before computers were anywhere close to being able to do it, he was speculating about how to teach a computer to play chess. And I'm sure if he were alive today, he would have a lot to say about Watson playing Jeopardy.
Danielle, no kidding. Danielle, with all this in your family, I mean, your dad was part of this.
Yes, he was. He was really there at the very, very beginning.
So are you inoculated, Danielle? Do you look out on the world and say, oh, whatever, information flows. My family has mastered them for generations.
No, not at all. I actually think it's very fascinating. And actually, my next question for Mr. Glick was, if Claude Shannon were alive today, where do you think he would be taking his work? What directions do you think that he would be taking and focusing on, given, you know, the Facebook and,
Talk about big ifs. That's wonderful. Let us pick it up, Danielle. And thank you so much for your call. James.
Well, we have millions of people now who are continuing the work that he started, and they're branching out in all different directions. Facebook and Twitter, which neither of which existed when I started working on this book, are in a way descendants of Shannon's work, even if the founders don't have to be immediately aware of the mathematics that underlie their computer networks. But Shannon's work has been influential in other areas, too. We've talked about biology. Psychology underwent profound changes when psychologists started to learn from computer scientists and at least keep an eye on engineers who were building their mechanical brains.
And on through Facebook and Twitter, and we visualize them playing hide-and-seek, and we're all playing hide-and-seek in that big info world now. Daniel, thank you so much. Luke in Quebec. Luke, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. I wonder whether I'm being very simplistic in thinking about information as something that has been there since the creation of the universe, and we've been picking at it ever since, and we're getting so good at extracting information that we're getting flooded by it.
As sort of information miners extracting away. Let's look at it. Jim, do we create it or do we extract it?
Well, both. And we don't own it. We may think that we're in charge of the information we've uncovered, but it tends to have a life of its own. So yes, I agree with the caller. It's there's a lot of information out there that we've become very good at finding, and it does threaten to overwhelm us.
But do you see us sort of picking away at a great ball of yarn that's sitting out there, or are we making it as we go? I mean, after all, who was it? We were quoting from you earlier saying that thought itself sort of influences the path we're on. We may change the information or the information that's in the forefront of our minds, our realities, and maybe thereby head into new arenas of information. Or are we just picking away at a great big ball that's sitting in front of us?
No, more than that. I mean, as we humans value our individuality and our creativity, and that's why I said we need to be not just the customers but also the librarians. Individual creativity is maybe more of a challenge now that we have so much access to what everyone else is doing and all of the information that already existed in the past. But when I look around, I don't see any shortage of artists and musicians and poets and bloggers trying to create new things.
Our time grows short, but there are so many callers. Let me get one more here. Milton, Massachusetts. Paul, thanks for calling, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Mr. Glick along the lines of how do you see the wave of information that we're dealing with? How does it impact the social contract between humans? Because basically, I mean, I'm in a client-facing business, so my job cannot be done unless I'm sitting in the same physical space with someone face-to-face talking back and forth, seeing visual cues and expressions and things like that. And, you know, we've gone from 1D, one dimension to two dimensions to three dimensions. And where does that, you know, we have an obligation to our fellow humans to stay in touch at some level of reality. And so the, you know, the people who are distracted by Facebook in traffic are aggravating others behind them because they forget to move when the traffic in front of them moves.
Right.
You know, where does the responsibility kick in? You know, where does society finally say, look, folks, you have to take a very active role in managing this and not just lie down and let it roll over you?
Managing it and living with it. Paul, our time is short, but I that's a great question. And James, I wonder as well. I mean, you know.
Well, let me say two things about that, even though our time is short.
Yes.
One is don't use your cell phone or your BlackBerry while you're driving your car. Duh.
Yes, you and, say that. But, you know, I was just down at South by Southwest, the interactive part of that festival in Austin, Texas. Good heavens, I've never seen more people wired sort of stem to stern, you know, a plug in their ear, a thing in their hand, a thing on their belt, a little visual thing in front of their glasses maybe. I mean, we are living now in a time when some people live in that traffic and others are really, they may be in the traffic, but they're in the cloud.
Right. And multitasking can be dangerous, but some things require one's full attention, and driving a car is certainly one of them. But about the caller's other point, there are different channels of communication, and they have different abilities. And as soon as people started talking on the telephone was just a fuzzy, stripped-down simulacrum of the human voice. In its early days, it was a lot less clearer than it is today. And you don't get facial expressions. You don't get smells. You lose a lot of nuance. Mm-hmm. So the caller said for his business, he needs to be face-to-face with people And that is absolutely true. When you have 5,000 friends on Facebook, you know that they are not as intimate as the three friends you actually live hours and days with in real life. We redefine our terms and we make our choices, and we need to be smart about it. If you choose to use Facebook or Twitter as your channels of communication, that's a choice you're making, and you're getting less of the full experience than if you're face-to-face.
There's a flood. We're all the librarians now, James Glick says. And one more from your great citations, Jean-Pierre Dupuis writing, it was inevitable that meaning would force its way back in. I guess we don't doubt that, even the flood, though. So many meanings glimmering in there. James Glick, it's been wonderful talking with you. It's a wonderful, big, ambitious book, and we congratulate you on it. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom. I've enjoyed it.
James Glick, author of The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.